You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a state Lyme disease expert about how to prevent tick bites this summer. Now, there are more than 400 private and public caves here in Wisconsin, and our next guest is a big fan of preserving them, exploring them, and helping other people explore them safely. Casey Fisk is chairman of the Wisconsin Speleological Society. The nonprofit organization is involved with cave mapping, research, tours, and more. Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be aboard.
Can you give us a taste of the kind of caves we have here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, most of the caves in Wisconsin are typically crawling caves. We don't have the large caves like we do down in Tennessee or Kentucky. The reason being is because of the different types of limestone that we have here in the state.
And what is it about caves that captured your interest?
Well, today would be the coolness of the caves.
Much
better to be underground right now than it is up on the surface. But it's one of the last frontiers on the earth as far as exploration. I think that's the biggest draw that I have. I just never know what I'm going to find. Maybe the first person that's ever seen anything that's underground.
If someone is interested in checking out caves and doesn't know where to start, what would you recommend as their first bit of exploration?
Well, the first thing I would suggest people would do to actually go to one of our show caves in Wisconsin. There's currently 4 show caves in Wisconsin. Probably the best one to start with would be Ledgeview Nature Center in Chilton, Wisconsin. Reason being is because it's non-lit caves that you're going into, and you actually will be crawling through the caves, whereas some of the other caves are all walking in lit passages.
Now, what's the difference? I see these words, spelunking and caving. What's the difference between the two?
Spelunkers are what we would call as non-professional cavers in the fact that they're inexperienced. Our thing that we always say about spelunkers is cavers actually have to go and rescue spelunkers. Spelunkers go into caves maybe with just a flashlight. They don't have the proper equipment. They get lost. Their lights go out, and they have to be rescued. And it's usually cavers that actually have to go in and rescue the person.
So starting with those show caves would be the good step for spelunkers because, they're a little more attended there, it sounds like.
Correct. That's give you a feel of the underground. And actually, like I said, at Ledgewood Nature Center or at Maribel Caves County Park, where we currently have most of our activities, to actually get in the cave and be crawling around in the dirt, see if you can enjoy it. So that would be where I would start.
And I know the Speleological Society is concerned, about doing this all safely, but also you're interested in preserving caves. What kind of things are important to know about?
Well, our organization has been doing a lot of restoration work in caves. There is, we'll go in and actually do excavation work in the cave to restore them. You had mentioned earlier in the startup that there's 400 caves in Wisconsin. That only represents about 10% of the caves that are actually here. Reason we don't have a lot of caves is because the glaciers fill them all in. So we as an organization have been restoring caves by taking out the glacial sediment. And then that provides access for people to come into the caves.
Now, if people get a little more advanced and they want to check out caves on their own, I know a really big issue also is making sure you get permission and not just bopping onto private property. What do people need to know?
Correct. Well, that's one thing. If they contact us, we're not going to give out cave locations because most of the caves in Wisconsin are on private property, and we just don't want people trespassing, and that leads to vandalism in the caves. What you should do is, get involved with Wisconsin Speleological Society, and then we would actually then probably allow you to go on some of our field trips where we go to different caves and you get, find out where the caves are at that point. But, we have to trust the people that go in. We just don't give out locations of caves.
I know there's a concern about bats and white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. How do you and your colleagues at the society help make sure that we humans aren't spreading that?
Well, that's a misnomer. Humans really do not spread. I know some people might disagree with that, but bats are communal animals. you know, they spread it themselves. They're always in the caves, they'll lick each other and stuff, and they spread it faster than we can. But for us as an organization, we stopped caving in the wintertime because that's when bats are hibernating in Wisconsin. So we don't do any caving at all in the wintertime if there's bats in the cave. There's an exception. If there's not bats in the cave, then we'll actually be working in the caves or caving.
And you mentioned various things going on this summer, good places to go. If people want to check out cave tours, what are some of the best opportunities for them over the next few months?
We actually, as an organization, provide cave tours. And they're always the third Sunday every month, May through October. And we have our main cave that we've excavated out up by Cherney Marable Caves County Park. That's right off I-43 between Green Bay and Manitowoc, and we provide the tours there the third Sunday every month for free. We do kind of ask for a $5 donation per family, and you get a really nice caving patch, but that's a great place to go. This year we also have on July 16th was a Saturday. That's a public tour, and this year we're doing for the first time candlelight tours in the cave, which will be July 2nd and 3rd, and that's all up at Maribel.
Casey, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. That's Casey Fisk, chairman of the Wisconsin Speleological Society. We talked to him about his effort to explore and protect caves around Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the hunt for the state's oldest tree.
The oldest known tree in Wisconsin looks nothing like you'd expect. It's not a huge, majestic tree. In fact, it's so unremarkable that it's easy to miss. WPR's Rob Menser has been looking for this tree for years, and he brings us the story of his search.
This is the story of a hike I took and how, after years of looking, I finally found the oldest tree in Wisconsin. Maybe. Sort of.
Where am I looking?
I think it could be one of those. I guess we don't know. Okay. When I imagined Wisconsin's oldest tree, I pictured a massive red oak with limbs the size of telephone poles. But that's not it at all. The oldest tree in Wisconsin, the oldest one we know about anyway, is a scrawny little red cedar that's growing out of the side of a cliff. I got interested in this tree about 4 years ago. I was working for a newspaper at the time, and I interviewed Douglas Larson, the scientist who discovered it in 1997. What he found was that cliffs all over the world support some of the oldest life on Earth. In Wisconsin, on a cliff formation called the Niagara Escarpment, he sampled a cedar tree that was nearly 1,300 years old. But the tree is hard to find. It's on private property in Brown County. I tried to track it down. I talked to people who had seen it. And I wrote that story for the newspaper, but I never did get to see the tree for myself.
I only learned that the tree existed a couple of years ago.
So wait, did you learn about this tree from me?
Yes, kind of. It was your article.
That's Jody Davies. She and her partner Clayton own a cannabis shop in Wrightstown.
And so I was literally asking everyone I knew that would come in, like, have you heard of this tree? Do you know where it is? Is it really here? And nobody knew.
Until one day, one of her customers said, yeah, I know where it is. I can take you out there. In September, Jody sent me a message on Facebook. Hi, Rob, she wrote. I was wondering if you ever found that tree. We're having a small field trip to go see it, and I wondered if you'd like to come along. I tried to play it cool, but yeah, I wanted to come along.
The Niagara Escarpment is actually...
At the Wrightstown Fire Station, a small group of us watched a documentary about the Niagara Escarpment.
I like to think of it as the ancient backbone of North America.
Hundreds of millions of years ago, this was the shoreline of a prehistoric lake. The same cliffs that create Niagara Falls in upstate New York wind through Wisconsin. Dennis Bining, whose house is at the bottom of the ledge, had gotten permission to bring the group of us on a hike to see the tree. The problem was, he told Jody, we couldn't get that close.
We had that tornado come through in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's going to be tough to get to the base of the ledge because of the devastation.
The other problem was the cliffs are hundreds of feet high. We got as close as we could to the tree, but it was still pretty far away. Dennis let us look through his binoculars, but if I'm honest, I wasn't 100% sure which tree growing out of the side of the cliff was the tree.
Did you get closer when you did your story?
No, I didn't get this close. No,
gotcha.
I drove down that road. And that was it. That was as close as we got. On the walk back, we tried to convince ourselves that we'd accomplished the mission.
Very cool. I mean, we saw it.
We did see it. We aren't sure exactly which one.
Yeah. But our eyes saw it.
Why can a scrubby little cedar tree growing from the side of a cliff live for 1,300 years? The face of a cliff is a terrible place to grow. It doesn't get good water. It doesn't have rich soil. But here's the secret. When you're growing from a cliff, no one bothers you. Most of the time, people can't even find you. But we did find the tree. We did get to see it. You know, probably.
WPR's Rob Mentzer brought us that story on Wisconsin's oldest tree. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the warmer weather means more time outside and the return of ticks. We'll talk to an expert about how to prevent Lyme disease. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This heat wave is a sure sign that summer is on its way, but that also means that ticks are back out in Wisconsin's wildlife. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and we want to help you prevent tick bites in the first place and prevent possible infection when you're out and about this summer. Rebecca Osborne is a vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm guessing most people have the message at this point, but just to make sure, Lyme disease is kind of a big deal in Wisconsin, right?
It is, unfortunately. We are considered one of those hotspots or high incidence states for Lyme disease. So that just means we have a lot of Lyme disease infections every year, unfortunately. And so it's important to try and think about prevention.
When do we need to think about it? You know, is it only when we're going deep into the forest or even in our own backyard? Where and when do we need to be aware of this?
Yeah, so the tick that spreads Lyme disease is called the black-legged tick. Also, kind of more familiar, might be the deer tick. And it's really associated with wooded areas. So if you live near a wooded location, it could, you know, crawl into your backyard, even if it's a lawn. Otherwise, if you're out hiking or walking the dog and you're next to the woods or walking through tall grass, even, you might come into contact with this tick. So it can occur in every county in the state. But again, those specific habitat types are really its favorite spot to hang out.
Okay, so let's start with the effort to not get a tick on us in the first place. What are our main get ready precautions?
Sure. So I like to think of it as sort of three steps of prevention. You can think about it before you go outside, during your time outside, and then after your time outside. And before is really thinking about, you know, trying to keep the ticks off you in the first place. So we recommend using an EPA or an Environmental Protection Agency registered insect repellent. And that can be one of many options. Many people have heard of DEET, but there's a lot of other options, including picaridin or oil of lemon eucalyptus. These are things that you spray directly on your skin or clothing. And it's always important to, you know, follow the label instructions carefully. There's also something you can use called permethrin. It's also considered a contact insecticide. So this is something you don't spray on your skin, but you spray on your clothing, your shoes, even your camping gear. And this is done in advance of your outdoor adventure. And it can kill ticks as well as prevent them from crawling on you for up to something like 5 to 7 washes. So that's a great option as well. While you're outside, it's great to think about just avoiding those high vegetation areas. So try to stay in the middle of the trail, avoid really brushy areas or areas with lots of leaf litter on the ground. This is where the ticks tend to hang out. And then after, very important, is to do a tick check. Check your whole body, yourself or your family members. You can always help others in your family, especially kids, check themselves. it's important to remember that some of the juvenile ticks can be as small as a poppy seed. So a really careful check of your entire body is important.
Yeah. So let's do our tick check now. Where are we looking and how do we know what is a tick, what is not a tick?
Great question. So ticks love to hang out in sort of the hard to see places. So, you know, back of your head and your hair, back of your knees, the neck, ears, you know, even places that you might need to use a mirror to find. You know, you can always ask a family member to help you look. I often encourage people to take a bath or a shower within 2 hours of coming indoors, because this is just another opportunity to find anything that might be crawling around you. Ticks can, you know, can be difficult sometimes to identify, especially if they're really small. They don't move very quickly, but you'll often see them, you know, crawling around. They have 8 legs and they have pretty big mouth parts, but they can be pretty tiny. So again, just look for anything that might be crawling around or may even be embedded in your skin. If you do get a tick bite, there's no need to panic. You just need to try and remove it as quickly as you can.
It is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, a great time to get outside. We're finding out how to stay safe. Rebecca Osborne is with us, a vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Okay, Rebecca, we've got the tick on us. There are a lot of wrong ways to remove a tick. Can you tell us the right way, please?
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation about how is the best way to remove a tick. So here is what we recommend. Go ahead and grab a pair of fine tip tweezers if you have one. Grasp the tick as close to the skin as possible. And you just need to pull upward and out with kind of a firm and steady tension. Here are some things not to do. Definitely don't use nail polish or a match. Try not to cover it in, you know, petroleum jelly. Any of those things are not helpful and may just prolong the time that the tick is embedded in your skin, which can increase your chance of infection. If you don't happen to have a fine tip tweezers, you can go ahead and use your fingers. We just recommend that you shield your fingers with, you know, a piece of tissue or some rubber gloves if possible.
And the remain calm point there. You know, when we find the tick, I'll speak for myself. I might freak out a little. I shouldn't, though.
Yeah, it can certainly be disconcerting to have a tick bite. Nobody likes them, but not every tick carries germs and not every tick bite results in infection. So if you do get a tick bite, like we mentioned, go ahead and remove it as quickly as you can. And we do recommend after you remove it that you just watch yourself for symptoms for the next 30 days. So that would be looking for a fever or a rash or other flu-like symptoms that might develop, again, up to a month after you remove that tick. And that may indicate that you have been infected with either Lyme disease or another tick-borne illness. So we recommend you call your doctor right away if you do develop symptoms and just talk to them about the tick bite that you had and when you had it. So it's good to mark it on your calendar. You can even save the tick in a plastic bag if that's helpful. Sometimes identifying the species of tick can help figure out if you're at high risk or low risk of a tick-borne disease.
Now, a lot of times people talk about that bullseye rash from a Lyme-contaminated tick bite. But, correct me if I'm wrong, you can get Lyme disease even if you didn't get that rash?
Yeah, that's correct. So an estimated 70% to sometimes 80% of people with Lyme disease will develop the classic bullseye rash. But there's that other proportion of the population that will either never develop the rash, or maybe you were bitten, for example, on the back of your head and you developed the bullseye rash but could never observe it. So it's still important to keep in mind that you may get sick with Lyme disease without having that bullseye rash. So that's why we recommend people also look for fever and other flu-like symptoms, you know, fatigue, just generally feeling unwell, joint pain, muscle pain, things like that might indicate a tick-borne disease.
And we've been focusing on humans mainly, but as you mentioned earlier, we might go walking with a dog. What kind of precautions can we take there?
Sure. So we always recommend that you, if you are a pet owner, that you talk to your veterinarian about tick prevention. There's a lot of options for animals, especially dogs, including a Lyme disease vaccine. But tick prevention can come in a topical treatment or an oral treatment. Again, we always make sure that you talk to your veterinarian about what's recommended for your pet. But there are ways to prevent ticks on your pet. And this is also important for human health because dogs especially are really talented at picking up ticks. And then they might come into your home. That tick might crawl off of your dog and onto a person in the house. So that's another way to try and prevent humans from getting bitten by ticks.
And Rebecca, it sounds like we're taking Lyme disease and these ticks pretty seriously. I hope, I don't want people to come away, you know, being scared to get out and enjoy nature, right? This is serious, but the benefits of getting out and enjoying nature are pretty serious too, right?
Of course. I mean, Wisconsin is, you know, gifted with so many wonderful places to explore. We have a beautiful, you know, outdoor adventures in our state. So we want people to understand that it's just something you need to keep in mind every time you go outside this time of year. But with a few pretty easy steps, you know, grab some repellent, maybe treat your clothing, think about a tick check when you're done. And that, you know, that can really go a long way from preventing any type of infection. And again, if you do get infected, most tick-borne diseases are treated effectively with antibiotics, which is why it's important to talk to your doctor if you think you might have a tick-borne disease.
Rebecca, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Rebecca Osborne is a vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She was with us today sharing practical advice on preventing tick bites and preventing Lyme disease this summer so we can enjoy nature, maybe when it cools off just a bit. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, when communities increase their police funding, what happens to local crime numbers? A new study finds more misdemeanor arrests, but not necessarily a lot of impact when it comes to violent crime. One of the researchers behind that study joins the show to share the details. And weeks are 7 days long, right? We're all pretty used to that. But why? Why seven? We'll check out the origins of the Sunday to Saturday system to find out why such an odd number became our standard. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear from a bacteriologist and NASA researcher on the possibility of life on other planets and some of the ethical questions we have to consider. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now, I've thought about this. Maybe you have too. Who or what could be living on other planets out there or moons? Or what might our own lives look like on the moon or Mars? But so far, we've got no evidence of other life, no ability to live anywhere, as far as we know, except here on Earth. Our next guest says life on other planets may be possible. It just might not be the kind of life you and I are living today. In collaboration with NASA, scientists are studying early life and evolution here on Earth to answer the question, is life possible on other planets? What would it take to start it? And should we give it a nudge? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the early origins of life on Earth? If we had the opportunity to give the process a nudge somewhere else in our solar system, say, should we do it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Betul Kachar is an assistant professor of bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. At UW, she runs an astrobiology research lab studying early life and evolution. She's the director of MUSE, that's NASA's Metal Utilization and Selection Across Eons program based in Madison. Betul gave a TED talk about the possibility of life on other planets and the ethical dilemmas surrounding that. Betul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you said something that really crystallized my thinking in that TED talk. I thought it was interesting on what the line is between chemistry, which is everywhere in the universe, and biology, which so far we only know about here on Earth. How do we even figure out that dividing line?
That's a very good question. We are working on figuring out that divide. If you think about it, life is a form of chemistry. And I briefly mentioned this in my TED talk as well, that we all are, and by we, I mean all living organisms on Earth are chemistries that have memory. We remember, we defy degradation, we exist, we survive, we perish, and we recycle. So the big question is, what's the division between chemistry and biology? We know that this happened on our planet at least once, billions of years ago. We are here to figure it out, and we want to understand how that happened.
What do we know about how that happened? What do we know about the key ingredients in that chemical recipe that allows that chemistry to develop memory, to start reproducing itself?
Well, I can tell you that we know a lot more than we did only even 20 years ago. We know the molecules that existed billions of years ago. We use today and the life around us today to predict or infer the past. We understand the environments that these molecules, these chemistries existed in billions of years ago. But of course, this is a very tricky job. We are trying to figure out what happened billions of years ago, and such occurrences left very little behind. So we have very little to work with to understand early environment and early life altogether, which makes it more fun.
Now, here's a question. You know, Earth's been around for for billions of years, 4+ billion years. Life came along in only some hundreds of millions of years, a short amount of time in that scale. So you could look at that and say, okay, that means life is pretty easy. We're going to find it all over the place in planets and moons around the universe. Or you could say, we haven't found it. Maybe there's something super special about Earth, and we're really rare, this life on Earth. Where do you fall on that?
These are great, great points. You would think that life is easy for emerging because Earth did it in less than a billion years, as you pointed out. I like to think of it as, you know, when we think we are old, we should always remember that life is 4 billion years old. So we are not at all, even though we may feel like aging fast, especially these days. It's important to think about life's processes and life's early chemistries within the nuance of evolution. We are thinking about an evolving system when we are thinking about early chemistries. So the question is, of course, how did this happen on our planet, or whether it happened once? Definitely Earth is a better chemist than us, because we haven't quite yet figured this out in the laboratories. And by we, I mean the broader astrobiology and origin of life community. I think that at the end of the day, we come to a realization more and more that we got something quite special here on Earth, that this may be the only planet that this, quote, miracle have happened. Even more the reasons for us to understand the beginnings of life here.
We're talking to Betul Kachar, assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. She studies the early origins of life here on Earth and what that tells us about whether or not we might find life on other planets. Betul, I am descended from, and you are descended from, and a fern plant and bacteria and whatever, all descended, it sounds like, from that earliest bit of life on Earth. Can we look at all of the genetics of us and somehow backtrack to figure out what those first ancestors would have looked like or been like?
That's exactly what I'm doing. And it's really exciting. So thank you for asking this. Think about that. All life on Earth shares a DNA molecule that we think existed also in our earliest ancestor. So we are walking heritage, a 4-billion-year-old. We carry this 4-billion-year-old heritage within us every day in everything that we do. And to make this very interesting, we share about 50% DNA with a banana, right? So this is very fascinating to me, and also shows how related we are. And yes, we are using a methodology in my lab to use this shared nuance within all life on this planet today to find out the common DNA sequences that existed billions of years ago, the ancient DNA that was present early on this planet. We also resurrect these ancient DNA that we computationally generate first. So we use mathematics and statistics to first figure it out, but then we resurrect these ancient DNA inside modern microbes and bacteria to figure out how they may have behaved billions of years ago.
All right, Betul, this sounds like a pretty big job already, trying to figure out our common ancestor, how it came somehow out of chemistry. On top of that, though, you're looking at not just Earth. You're trying to figure out what conditions there could be on other planets. I mean, why, on top of what you're already doing, what made you want to pursue, you know, the rest of the universe, too?
Exactly. I like to think of it as that this is the best job in the universe. I mean, think about it. I am a biologist in the only known place in the entire universe where you can be one. This is definitely a very special job. And Rob, I like to think that, you know, some people travel the world to understand life. And don't get me wrong, I love to travel the world as well. But on top of that, I like to think of it as time travelers as well. We come to the lab to travel back in time to figure things out. And yes, as you said, the ultimate goal is then to connect what we learn in the lab to the galactic, to universal scale of life as a potential phenomena in the entire universe. It's quite exciting to be an astrobiologist.
Now, I'm a science fiction guy, and there's all sorts of stories about, you know, terraforming other planets or moons, like making them like Earth. You're thinking about a different question, though. Not can we replicate, can we bring Earth biology to another place, but can we nudge a planet, say, to have the conditions that Earth did to create its own life? Can you talk about that a little?
Exactly. So my TED Talk was about why we need to cherish this miracle of life on Earth. And one potential thought experiment that I wanted to suggest was exactly what you mentioned. It really started with a big what if. What if we are the only place in the entire universe that life exists? This was really inspired by my interactions with the general public. Every time I give a public talk and ask a simple question, how many of you think that there might be life elsewhere in the universe? Almost the entire audience raises their hand. We seem to think that there is other life in the universe simply because perhaps there are a lot of planets and many different possibilities out there that we know more now. But what if that is not the case? What if this is the only planet that harbors life? So I wanted to take the audience to a journey with me, starting with this possibility, and then also connecting that with a possible discovery that we might be very close to, which is figuring out how life started here. So if we were the only planet with life, and if we figure out how life started here, what do we get to do with that knowledge? And it's exactly what you pointed out, that I wanted to ask the audience, should we spread chemistries that may potentially give or allow a planet, a distant planet perhaps, to give birth to life? And that is different than terraforming. That will be different than moving Earth-like life elsewhere.
We're talking to Betul Kachar, researcher with NASA and assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison, looking at the origins of life on Earth, the possibility of life on other planets, if we on Earth should help create the possibility of life on other planets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Betul asks her live audiences, do you think there is life out there on other planets, or do you think we're all alone? Raise your hand and then use that hand to call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And when and if we have the capability, should we try to create Earth-like conditions on other planets? Or do you want to play one of my favorite games, Terraforming Mars, someday? Or do you like Betul's notion of creating the conditions for life and then seeing what happens and if it comes out different than what we have here on Earth? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the origins of life with Betul Kachar, looking at her research on early life on Earth and the potential for life elsewhere. With NASA, Betul is studying the missing piece that could allow life on other planets. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the origins of the earliest forms of life billions of years ago here on Earth? Do you have thoughts on whether we humans ought to try to create the conditions for life on other planets? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey, friend. I totally believe that there's life on other planets, and I totally believe that whatever that life is, they are intentionally trying to avoid us. Because we've fouled things up here so bad that they want us to just leave them alone. That's what I think.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Betul, this is a question you think about, given our track record here on Earth, do we have the right to potentially, as Mark says, mess things up on other planets?
That's a great point. And that's exactly the nuance that I was aiming to bring on the table, that we perhaps should not be messing with other planets and instead study them very carefully and understand their conditions. So sending whatever the chemistries we potentially, and again, let me remind everyone that this is a thought experiment,
right.
Would be about perhaps providing more of what that planet has, would not be about contaminating the other environment or this location with what we got here.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Betul, from our vantage on Earth and, you know, some satellites in orbit and a couple samplers on Mars and whatnot, like how easy is it, would it be for us to tell if there was life on another planet?
This is a great question, Rob, because there's a lot of investment and effort right now in order to improve our telescopes that are allowing us to see further and further. We have the James Webb Telescope, and there's going to be really remarkable images coming from there. We are expecting these in years to come. And the research on exoplanets, these are the planets outside of our solar system, has never been this exciting. More and more, we are learning how to best predict the environments, what would the signatures that we are observing might mean. As we get better and higher resolution in our telescopes, we will be able to see further and beyond. So this is a great time to study these sort of space-related disciplines, I think, in colleges and universities. And UW-Madison also has a very strong foundation and future in origin of life and astrobiology and space biology in general.
Now, here's something I wonder about. You know, we're pretty good at recognizing forms of life as they evolved here on Earth. Is it possible that there might be life somewhere else that is different enough in some way that we might have trouble even recognizing it as a form of life?
That's entirely possible. But we are basing our understanding on what we got here to start. And I need to point out, and this also goes to Brian's point earlier, Earth is my favorite planet. We should not take life on Earth for granted. And perhaps realizing what happened here and understanding it thoroughly, and this goes to exploring what is out there as well, would motivate us better to protect our home. Planet Earth is our home. And definitely exploration and space exploration should and does start here.
We're talking to Betul Kachar from UW-Madison, looking at her research on early life and its evolution here on Earth and what it means for life possibly existing elsewhere. Still time for your calls with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think we're alone out there? Do you think there's life on other planets? If there is not life on a planet, should we help it start? 800-642-1234 is the number. Betul, I wanted to ask you about this MUSE project with NASA. You're looking at metals and why some seem to be involved in the development of life, or this is part of your research. Some seem to be involved in the development of life, others not so much. What are you looking at there?
Right. So I recently moved to Madison to establish a NASA Astrobiology Research Center as a part of my laboratory and research program at the Department of Bacteriology. our goal is very clear. How can we expect to find anything else out there or to even understand or come close to understanding the universe if we do not understand what we have here? This is where we start. We lack a deep understanding, and forget about deep. We lack an understanding of our own life and our own life's history on this planet. And this is exactly what I'm going back to, that we should not take what we have around us for granted. I think most of the time when we think of space, we forget that we are in it. We are life in space ourselves. Yet we lack understanding of how things evolved and how environment and this planet itself led to this magnificent biology that we see around us today. So my center, MUSE, is a 5-year project. It's a multi-million dollar, multi-institution nationwide. We're connecting multiple institutes project that looks into how does elements, in particular metals, factor into life as we know. Because the question is, we are looking for life as we know elsewhere, but can we look at the metals and elements elsewhere to predict whether life that we know or something like it will rise in these bodies?
Time for another caller. Jack is with us in Eagle River. Jack, hello.
Hello. I would like to know if we, I don't think we should be planting our life on another planet, but can we search for this type of chemistry that might be life and infuse either something like a fertilizer or an enzyme into it to assist it along?
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. And that brings us back to your big thought experiment, Betul. How much, what kind of nudging hypothetically could it take, say, at a place like Mars to help create the preconditions for life?
Thank you, Jack. Your question has two layers. At the one level, we do such experiments on Earth. We try to understand what would it take for a chemistry to transition into biology. Does it miss an enzyme, as you pointed out, or is it a certain element or a metal or a different, completely different environmental condition? So researchers are creating these sort of environments, or I would say simulating these sort of ancient Earth conditions on Earth to understand this very transition. At the same time, we are now studying our own neighborhood, right? We study Venus, we study Mars, we will be going to different moons. So definitely there is a lot of knowledge coming from different planets and moons within our solar system, and will be. We understand their chemistries. However, we lack that very connection. It's almost like judging a book by its cover. We can look at them, we understand their chemistries to some degree, but we don't know why they don't have life.
All right, Betul, we just have a minute left, and I got to ask, suppose I somehow had this toolkit where 100% I drop this on a planet, it's going to create these preconditions for life. We're not going to drop any Earth bacteria or anything in there with it. If you had that capability, would you do it?
I knew you would ask me this. I honestly think that we may not have any other choice. If we figure out that we are the only forms of life in the universe, and if we end up destroying ourselves at the speed that we do we have to, we may have to ask ourselves whether we should replicate or at least spread the miracle that we have here. It may come down to that. And I, for one, think and understand that life, even if we did something like this, it would take billions of years for anything to be born in wherever we are sending. So this would almost be backing up what we got in a more profound way than only perhaps planting some Earth-like seeds elsewhere. And by seed, I mean actual plant seeds, or terraforming different planets by sending them Earth microbes. This would be a little bit more deeper, nuanced than that. Can you tell I watched a lot of Star Trek?
Betul, I can. And thank you so much for sharing your research with us today.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
That's Betul Kachar, assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. She runs an astrobiology research lab there studying early life and evolution, also does work with NASA on the origins of life. Coming up after the news, we talk to an extremism expert about the arson at an anti-abortion rights office in Madison and other politically motivated violence. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.